Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. Last week, Amazon Go opened in Seattle. After nearly 2 years of planning and testing, Amazon revealed the prototype for cashierless stores. There isn't even a checkout line. Coming up, we talk more about how the Amazon Go store scenario could disrupt the entire retail industry. Joining us now by phone is Seattle Times business reporter Matt Day. Welcome to the show, Matt.
Thanks, Ann. Good to be here.
So you visited Amazon Go, right?
I did, yeah.
What was it like?
Just after it opened last week. Oh, it was interesting. You sort of scan on your way in, just like if you have a sort of mobile airline ticket. And then once you're in, you just basically pick anything you want off the shelf and head out. And it's pretty much that simple.
Are there any employees at all?
There are, yeah. And it's hard to tell how many there's going to be on sort of an ongoing basis because of the frenzy around the opening. There were, it was clearly a well-staffed place, and Amazon had some public relations folks wandering around making sure everything was going properly. Mm-hmm. But, there's a kitchen staff in the back working on sort of prepared food items. And Amazon says there will be, staff making sure people can get in okay. And if something goes wrong, there's folks wandering around.
There was apparently a very long line to get into a place with no checkout, right?
Oh, yeah, that was a great irony. It opened at 7 a.m. before dawn out here last Monday. And, there were about 100 people lined up at that point. It kind of filtered out as people moved through. And then come lunchtime, there was a line halfway around the block, which is a great irony for a store designed to get rid of lines.
What was your impression of how people were reacting to it?
I think it's hard to tell. It's a lot of curiosity.
Right.
And it was at least among sort of people in during the first week, it was a lot of sort of, tech savvy young folks and people who work in tech sort of around the Amazon headquarters campus here in Seattle. But I think people were pretty excited and pleasantly surprised in a lot of cases about it.
What's it like? How does it work?
You first of all, you have to download the Amazon Go smartphone app. That's sort of a condition of entry. Scan it on the way in, and then from there, Amazon basically tracks you as you move throughout the store. There are dozens and dozens of little black sort of paperback book-sized boxes hanging from the ceiling. Those are all sensors, each has a camera pointing a specific direction. And some combination of those and Amazon's sort of unseen software somewhere on the back end tracks you as you go through the store. And so when you pick an item off the shelf, it's able to identify that was you that took it, what the item was. If you put it back up on the shelf, it takes it out of your cart, and then as soon as you leave, the system charges you for whatever it assesses that you took.
This store is, I guess, kind of like a prototype. It's the first one ever. Is this what they're envisioning for other stores opening up eventually, or is this a prototype on many levels? It's not just the first one, but it may be different in other places.
I think it could be different. Amazon hasn't said a whole lot about where they plan to take this, but I think few people realistically think they would have spent so much money testing this concept and not take it to sort of a wider distribution. Amazon, of course, bought Whole Foods Market last year, giving them a giant sort of physical grocery footprint. There's a lot of speculation that perhaps they could try to apply this sort of cashierless concept to a Whole Foods store or two. Maybe they sort of expand this convenience store concept they have going now. I think people are expecting them to go big with this at some point.
There were a lot of food items, freshly made food items. As you mentioned, there are employees in the back whipping these things up. I was a little surprised at that. What did you make of that?
Well, I think they want to, at least with this first trial, they want to hit sort of a sweet spot between a, sort of 7-Eleven type fare and a little bit more upscale sort of breakfast and lunch offerings. They definitely think of this as sort of a particularly with the convenience aspect, a way to sort of attract office workers on their lunch break, that kind of thing.
And how did you check out the food? What did you think?
I did. It was pretty good. I sampled a couple of their salads and sandwiches, and yeah, it wasn't bad. It's pretty decent stuff.
How big was the store? What can you compare it to in terms of size?
Yeah, so it's pretty small. It's 1,800 square feet, and sort of in practice, the selection feels like it. Again, it's definitely a convenience store, not a full grocer. But there's a decent selection of stuff. I was just in there the other day. There was four kinds of coconut water. They've got a pretty wide selection of Whole Foods items and snacks and sort of a prepared meal and takeout section as well.
What I mean, is there a place where you can buy a bottle of aspirin and some chapstick or what?
I don't think so. so. Come to think of it, I think, yeah, it is pretty strictly food and beer and wine. Though there are, you know, some sort of takeout goodies, travel mugs and bags and the like. But I'm not sure there's any sort of pharmacy or you know, chapstick component to it.
So beer and wine, that means they're IDing you as well?
Yeah, they are. They have a little walled-off section in the back far corner staffed by somebody there to check ID on entry.
All right, so there is someone there doing that. Do you need to have an Amazon Prime membership, or do you just need to be registered with the company?
Yeah, you do not need to have a Prime membership. Just the only conditions to getting in is just having an Amazon account that you link to a credit or debit card, and then downloading the app. In a lot of spots that Amazon has sort of tried retail experiments, they've required you to be a member of their $99 a year Prime program. Mm-hmm. But in this case, they've left open to just the general public as long as you're registered with the company.
Wow, you're giving them a lot of information, huh?
Yeah, you could say that. They haven't told us sort of how exactly their system works, other than sort of the vague technology of it. But you know, it would certainly seem to raise questions about sort of what data they're taking from you, how long they store it, what they're doing with it.
But as you said, most of the people that seem interested in this are younger. They're digital natives. This isn't an issue for them.
Yeah. I think like in a lot of cases, sort of modern privacy debates, you know, sort of young folks don't think about it necessarily. And that was definitely the case with plenty of people that I talked to last week.
What was it kind of weird walking out without even going through a checkout line?
Oh, definitely. You kind of have to unlearn some habits. I mean, they encourage you to, you know, if you're carrying a bag with you or if purchased one in store, just put things directly in sort of your shoulder bag or the one you're shopping with, which feels a little odd. Just taking things and being able to pocket them if you want, and then just leaving, you sort of feel like you're shoplifting.
Well, yeah, you feel like you're shoplifting, but anything but, because you have to be registered to get in. So you're on there. They know you've been there. And if you can't really shoplift leaving it, right?
No, not at all. I mean, plenty of media folks have tried to swipe items out of there with very limited success. I mean, I've only been aware of a couple of cases where people successfully managed to get out with something that that they weren't charged for. The system seems to be pretty good, at least it's set up now, at identifying what you've taken off the shelf.
And what about customer service? As you said, when it was opening, when you went, you know, there's a lot of fuss being made. They always want to make it look good. Whenever a grocery store opens, there's always a lot more people than there are 2 years later. But what did they say about what they expect their staffing will be like?
No, they haven't commented on exactly how many people it takes to run this thing or how many will be on duty at any given time. But, you know, it is the store is stocked, you know, by hand. And, you know, I think just as long as the concept remains new, they're going to have people sort of available to help customers. So I'd be surprised if, you know, the place goes fully invisible in terms of staffing anytime soon. And at least when I was there last week, they had, you know, it's more than a dozen kitchen staff in the back and perhaps half a dozen people inside the store sort of helping out or restocking.
Okay. Well, that's a lot of people for an 1,800 square foot operation.
No, yeah, absolutely. This is not cheap to run, at least initially.
What were the prices like?
They felt sort of comparable to, other convenience stores. It wasn't the cheapest thing, but it didn't seem like an outrageous luxury good going in there at all.
Uh-huh.
You know, sandwiches for $6-7, salads for a couple dollars more, which, you know, for sort of the downtown core around Seattle, it's about what you pay, or about as cheap as you're going to pay for a lunch.
And no matter what, Amazon, that's what it's known for, is it can afford to lose a little in the process of disruption.
Yeah, and that's a lot of what sort of analysts who track the company think they're doing with this, is that there is no pressure on Amazon to sort of roll this out immediately or to expand it nationwide. But what it immediately does is it sort of puts pressure on, you know, sort of every other retail who's, you know, now worried about, is Amazon going to use this concept to move into my neighborhood? And, you know, in a lot of cases, retailers operating on really thin margins don't have either the tech savvy or the cash to do an experiment like this on their own.
So what are your expectations for what Amazon will do with this? Do you think they'll open up another one in Seattle and that kind of thing? So it's kind of a apples versus apples comparison as far as they study the process and learn more about it.
No, a couple of analysts I talked to last week are pretty convinced that they're going to open at least a few more of these in other major markets around the U.S. just to get more data and see how it works and try to iron out the kinks in their system and sort of plan where they go from here. It was sort of an unusually long incubation period for the company. They were testing this thing for more than a year just among their employee base in Seattle. So I think there's a thought that, you know, both the complexity of the technology and sort of how they think about the market, it could take them a while to decide how big to take it.
Mm-hmm. And what were the glitches in it that took so long?
Yeah, so they haven't commented on exactly what went wrong, but from people that we've spoken to or who are familiar with the project, it struggled to track people when the store was crowded. That the technology also struggled at times. You know, if you're standing right next to somebody, whose arm is that reaching out to grab the carton of milk, that kind of thing.
Yeah.
So that for at least a time, it's unclear how much of that's still going on, but there were, you know, real life humans reviewing purchases to make sure that it lined up with what, you know, the automatic sensors were telling them.
They do limit how many people can be in the store at one time.
Yes, that's correct. The only limit, though, is fire code, which is about 100 people.
Oh, okay. So they just had to adjust to that. What is your sense? I mean, are people going to go back? Is this just an oddity? Is it enough of a convenience? Do people really hate standing in checkout lines that much?
That's a great question, and I'm not sure the answer to it. I mean, certainly the initial reaction here was one of curiosity, and I'll be eager to see if people are lining up again come lunchtime, you know, today or tomorrow. But some of the folks who did consumer research on this after the concept was announced a couple of years ago went out and polled customers of retailers and said, you know, is this a big deal for you? And you know, for a surprisingly large number of them, it was. You know, particularly at sort of wholesalers where you wind up waiting in line for a while, a Sam's Club or a BJ's and Trader Joe's customers in particular. This is according to Magid, a Minneapolis research outfit. They were interested in a concept like this just because it's such a pain point for them to wait in line for so long.
Huh. Well, Matt Day, I want to thank you for joining us today. I appreciate your time.
Well, thanks for having me.
That's Matt Day. He's a business reporter for the Seattle Times. Coming up, we're going to talk about what this triggers in the rest of the retail world, disruptions like this, how do they matter, and what we can expect going forward. You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. We just heard about Amazon's new cash-free, cashier-free convenience store in Seattle. Amazon Go also requires shoppers to create online accounts just to shop in a store. Both moves suggest possibilities for what retail could look like moving forward, but only for the stores themselves. Not only for the stores themselves, but also for those who shop in them and work in them. We're talking about the future of retail shopping and retail consumers. Joining us by phone is grocery and retail industry analyst and the founder of SupermarketGuru.com, Phil Lempert. Welcome back, Phil.
Thank you, Ann.
Also joining us, CEO of Shoot Gerdeman, a retail design firm in Columbus, Brian Chaffley. Welcome.
Hi, Ann. Good to be with you.
And by phone, Bloomberg retail columnist and former retail reporter for The Washington Post, Sarah Halzack. Welcome, Sarah.
Thanks, Ann.
You recently wrote about the impact, Sarah, of Amazon Go on retail employees and retailers. You're saying we shouldn't be too worried about the elimination of the cashier job. Why not?
I'm saying it's just a little too early to be worried about that, and here's why. When my colleague from Bloomberg News went to visit the Amazon Go store, he actually saw about 12 people working, some of them making salads and sandwiches, some restocking shelves, one was checking IDs for wine, and that's in an 1,800-square-foot store. That's a quite tiny store, about the size of a 7-Eleven. And so what we don't have clear indication of yet is how many jobs this is going to eliminate. And I do think if I were a retail worker, I'd certainly be worried of the direction that this technology suggests that the entire industry could be going.
Yeah, I mean, as we mentioned in the last segment, Amazon can afford to tinker with this for a long time, actually, and it doesn't look so bad. But it is its flagship on this score, and, you know, they can invest more in human resources to make it look good, right?
They can, yes. And it's just unclear how this will translate into other sectors of the retail industry. You know, a Walmart store is 180,000 square feet. Does this technology, this mix of cameras, sensors, AI, it works in a small space? Would it work as well in a large space? We don't know that yet. And there's other types of retailing environments where this might not be relevant. Sure, in consumer packaged goods, where we're all just sort of running in and grabbing the milk or butter that we need to make our dinner that night, it's helpful. But in a luxury retailing environment, for example, when you're selling $5,000 handbags, is this model really relevant, appropriate, and applicable? And I think all of that shapes how many retail jobs will ultimately be affected by this.
You know, Phil Lempert, I kind of think that maybe, you know, in my mind, the Whole Foods opportunity, they could start doing sort of mini stores inside of a Whole Foods where you could do a convenience store Whole Foods kind of a scenario and start spreading it that way.
There's no question about that, Ann. And in fact, for Food Lion, when they had a chain called Bloom, they actually did exactly what you're describing. In the front of the store was the 100-plus items that were most frequently bought as a convenience store. So it was a store within a store. But let's not forget, you know, this is an experiment. There's no question about it. But with the increasing minimum wage, and now in 19 states and growing to $15 an hour, you know, the bottom line is these retailers are not going to be able to afford without raising prices significantly, as we've seen in food service already, in fast food restaurants. They've got to automate. They've got to cut jobs because they can't afford $15 an hour.
You know, I didn't want to go macroeconomics on everybody, but what's the theory, though, Brian Schaffley, about how people can afford to shop at these places if they don't have jobs?
Well, that truly is a great question. I think that, you know, how can afford people shop? You know, what they're going to do is increasingly go elsewhere. They're going to shop more online. But, of course, the food category is a category that you know, it's a lot of impulse, and I think Amazon Go, you know, is taking advantage of that with this first foray into, you know, into the convenience area. It'll be interesting to see if it does translate to other categories. You know, there's been a lot of speculation that, you know, Amazon may buy Target or Costco, Lowe's, Macy's, and I think it'll be fascinating to see, you know, whether this translates to, you know, customers across the country rather than just, you know, sort of tech savvy digital natives in Seattle. And so I think, you know, that'll be the biggest thing to watch on this in terms of its application to broader retail.
You know, Sarah Halzack, I you know, it's an experiment on a lot of different levels. It's an experiment on the technology. It's an experiment on staffing levels and what you need to support something like that. And it's also an experiment on what do people buy. I mean, the amount of data they're getting from this is phenomenal.
Yeah, and I think you really hit on something interesting here, which is how does this change consumer behavior? So, for example, I've talked to companies that make the touch screens that you might see in a chain restaurant like Panera Bread, where you do your own ordering.
Yeah.
And what they've noticed is that kiosks are much better at upselling you on stuff than human beings. And the theory is that probably what's happening is you feel a little less embarrassed adding that extra cookie to your order when it's just a computer than you do asking a human being being for that cookie. And you think about that principle and that logic and how that could apply in the Amazon Go format. It's very powerful. Does this shift consumers to making different kinds of purchases and more impulse buys than they would before? Remember, with the initial rise of e-commerce, there was all this conversation about, is the impulse buy dead? Well, maybe this reinvigorates it and simply changes it.
Well, I'm here to testify that the impulse buy is not dead. I'm the worst there ever was. Phil, you wrote that traditional retailers should fear Amazon Go for three reasons. I want to hear those reasons, but why wouldn't traditional retailers just adopt the technology of Amazon Go?
Well, I think they will, and I think that Amazon's play here is to be able to develop this technology and license it to other retailers as well. I don't think that, you know, in the current form, we're not going to see, you know, 500 or 5,000 Amazon Go stores, you know, throughout the nation. I don't think that that's their plan. Mm-hmm. I think that's too small for them. But I do think that once they can perfect this, and keep in mind, Walmart is working on the same project, same type of project, that we will see an era where we're going to have this. Now, this had been talked about probably for about 20 years, but before this, it was all about RFID chips. And until that price of RFID chips could fall less than 1 cent, the bottom line is we would have an RFID chip in just about every product. So this kind of technology, for me, is frankly, it's old hat. And in fact, I think it's very cumbersome. The New York Times wrote about the fact that there were kids that were in the store moving products around, and it really fooled the sensors and the cameras. So if we can get to that RFID chip...
You mean taking things from one shelf and moving to another shelf?
Yes.
Okay.
Absolutely. And that, you know, destroyed their algorithm or whatever else. So, you know, the technology is there to do it just simply with an RFID chip, being able to, you know... You don't even have to check in with your mobile device as you come in to that kiosk, but just an RFID chip would trigger it as you walked out of the store.
Well, what do they want to punch it into my, you know, my temples or whatever? I mean, I guess it seems like it's going that way. Email from Marianne. She says, I was sick and tired and in line with three items at a small grocery yesterday. The clerk scanned one item, then turned to help the next cashier scan four bottles of wine and a six pack of beer for a young customer, also checking that person's ID while I waited. I say, bring on the Amazon stores. Okay, thanks for that email, Marianne. It's kind of interesting, though, Brian Schaffley, that there already are pranksters. But oh. I'm sure Amazon says, bring them on. Bring
Absolutely.
It on. We want to know how you're going to prank us so we can figure out how to stop it in the future.
Yeah, I read one report where one journalist actually was able to get away with one item that they didn't pay for. And then they contacted Amazon to see what they would do or how they would respond. Mm-hmm. And they said, Amazon said, you know, look, our mistake, please enjoy it. And I think they've built in a certain amount of shrinkage, as it's known in the industry, mm-hmm. Lost product or lost revenue. But they know that's going to be part of the learning process for them. They're going to, you know, write off a certain amount of that in their larger plan.
Yeah. And Phil, you wrote about the reasons why traditional retailers should fear Amazon. One is communication. They know how to communicate.
Yeah.
Yep.
What's so great about how they communicate?
Well, you know, keep in mind that Amazon has really taken the lead in online shopping, in being able to suggest different items. Supermarkets have had frequent shopper cards for probably now going on 30 years, and they don't have a clue what to do with them. I mean, it's basically just, you know, cents off, it's paperless coupons. And for Amazon, a technology company, to really mine that consumer intelligence, that's the brilliance of it. So they're able to talk to consumers, are able to suggest other things. As Sarah pointed out, you know, on a kiosk, you know, you can upsell much easier than, you know, having a human being do it. So I think what we're really going to see is Amazon being able to mine this data, not only in this store, but also to be able to use this kind of learnings in Whole Foods. Whole Foods doesn't have a frequent shopper card. Mm-hmm. And frankly, their communication with customers has been dismal over the years.
Mm-hmm. If I could add to that, Ian, you know, I think that online retailers have a huge advantage because, In Amazon's case, they know not only what you buy, but what you looked at, what you searched for, what you browsed, and of course your purchase history dating back, you know, for many years. Most retailers don't have that. They may know what you bought through credit card data or loyalty programs, but they don't really know what you looked at, what else, you know, you were interested in the shopping experience. And I think that's the holy grail for a lot of, you know, bricks and mortar retailers, is to figure out how to mine some of that data, how to collect that data, and then what to do with it to sort of improve their stores and their assortments going forward.
Sarah Halsak, it sounds like they could change what we have a choice of in the future.
They could. And I think the real power of this comes, and this is what Brian and Phil were getting at, is when you just marry up what you're learning about the customer in the brick and mortar store with what you're learning about them online. I think this is a problem that retailers have in spades right now, is that they do have this pretty good profile of what I do when I'm on their website, and they have no way of connecting that to what I do when I'm in the store. So they keep serving me ads for a product I looked at online, not realizing I went to their store and purchased it last week, and they should have been spending their time sending me an ad for a different product that was related. They're not doing a good job of sort of marrying up and having a full sort of 360-degree profile of who you are as a shopper. And you can see the power of this technology and how it could reshape that dynamic.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Amazon Go store opened in Seattle last week. We heard from a Seattle Times reporter about what it was like, what the experiences were like. Now we're talking to retail experts about, you know, what this bodes for the future in retail. If you have a question or comment, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. We've already heard from an email from Mary Ann, who said, bring on the Amazon stores. She doesn't like waiting in line for just a few items. That's kind of part and parcel of the experience. I mean, even now, you even have to wait in line now to do your self-checkout, which feels a lot like putting gas in your car, too. I'm not sure exactly what the benefit of that is anymore. So, Phil Lempert, what do you think this means in other ways for the future of retail that we haven't thought of yet? I mean, that's not right in front of us.
Well, and one point I'd like to make before I answer that is that every time I get in the self-checkout line, that's when a dad has decided to teach their five-year-old how to use it. And it's a horrible experience. It's absolutely horrible.
Or it's right behind me, where every time I use it, there's a problem. You know,
exactly.
I scan things too quick, or I don't scan them well, and, you know, whatever.
So I think what the future holds for us is really automatic replenishment. So as we move into the era of smart refrigerators and smart cupboards, just imagine that what we're going to do is we're going to go online with whatever retailer that is, whether it's a Safeway, whether it's a Kroger, whether it's Amazon or Whole Foods, whoever it is, and we're going to say we don't want to run out of certain things. For example, milk. I never want to run out of milk. So as I put that container of milk in and out of my refrigerator, the scanner that's inside of that door is going to register what that product is. Then the scale, which is that shelf, is going to determine, you know, how much I've used. So when it comes down to one day, all of a sudden, milk is going to magically appear. And we're seeing that more and more in different kinds of technologies. In fact, the IBM lab in North Carolina had this kind of stuff 15 years ago. It's just that we as consumers weren't ready for it. We never want to run out of bottled water or toilet paper or paper towels, those branded items that are not impulse shopping. So what that means is that 50,000 square foot store is a dinosaur. It's going to come down to probably about 20,000 square foot, 25,000 square foot. It's all going to be exciting foods, fresh foods. We're going to be able to, you know, have conversations with the fishmonger and the butcher, and really understand and get closer to our food than ever before. So for me, it's all about that automatic replenishment for those branded items that we never want to run out of,
but that we need no matter what.
Exactly.
Paul in Akron, you're on the air. Hi, Paul.
Hi, good morning, Ann. How are you doing?
Good, thanks.
I was listening to your conversation, and one element that seems to be missing for me is poor people. People who don't have smartphones, people who don't have credit cards, mm-hmm. and people who live in food deserts. How are these changes to retail going to affect all of them? I'll hang up and listen.
That's a really good question, Paul. Sarah Halzack, is that something that retailers care about? Are they thinking about that? Anybody?
They sure are, especially the ones that cater to that demographic quite significantly, such as a Walmart or a Dollar General. I think it's true you probably won't see this technology come to those kinds of stores as quickly, particularly if it's expensive to implement. A Walmart or a Dollar General or an Aldi operates on very low margins, and investing this kind of CapEx might be, or capital expenditure might be hard for them to do. But it's definitely, I think this question of poor people is a really interesting one, even when you look at the broader e-commerce landscape. Mm-hmm. As more and more of our shopping moves online, and as that's where the price wars are, folks who are unbanked, who don't have bank accounts or who don't have credit cards, are blocked, sort of boxed out of that environment. And some retailers don't accept SNAP benefits, food stamps, via their online websites. And so that definitely is a question, and poor folks are certainly being left out of some of these innovations at this point.
Yeah. Brian?
Yeah, I think your caller makes a great point. I think that there's a word going around relating to Amazon Go and similar concepts, and that is frictionless shopping, where, it's sort of like remove all of the, anxiety or difficulty about accessing, what you're trying to buy, whether, no matter what social strata you're part of. But, for some, it seems like, well, that's a first world problem. Mm-hmm. How hard is it to go to the store and
right.
Buy, groceries for my family and so forth. But it is true that, there is a vacuum in some places, a food desert, as you said. And, will technology be able to help, solve that? Will there be, distribution available to people to get, I guess better, wider distribution of food in at all price levels? And I do think that, that's going to be one of the biggest things that retailers are going to wrestle with is, as technology becomes more and more part of the shopping, shopper journey, how do you not leave people behind, people that aren't tech savvy or, have access to all of this technology? Not everybody's going to be, have refrigerators that, automatically replenish mm-hmm. the milk. But I do think all of these changes in retail are very good news for consumers at all levels. I think that it's going to help, drive prices down. Consumers are going to demand it. And for retailers, it'll be survival of the fittest.
Phil Lumpert?
Absolutely. I agree with everything that's said. And also keep in mind what we're now starting to see also, and retailers are very nervous about blockchain, where basically we can eliminate the retail environment. There's a company out of Russia called INS, and they've raised, I think now it's about $60 million, and a bunch of that money came from Unilever, where they want to go directly from the brand to the consumer and bypass the retailer to the point of saving money. They estimate that they can reduce prices by about 30-35% on average good that we would buy by just having this kind of system in place. So I think that there's a lot of changes taking place. And also, frankly, and I've been in the food world my entire life. My grandfather's a dairy farmer. My father's a food manufacturer. This is the most exciting time we've ever seen. And we're also attracting from the retail sector people who are graduating from Harvard and Stanford. All of a sudden, being in the food world is kind of cool. And we've never been the cool guys before. So I think it's really exciting if you look at what's gone on in Silicon Valley, whether it's, with companies like Instacart, whether it's cellular agriculture, we're really seeing a lot more innovation in food than we've ever seen before.
But will poor people be left behind?
Well, it depends on how you describe poor people. Mm-hmm. You know, I am not a fan of the term food deserts. And one of the reasons for that is it's fine to pop up a 50,000 square foot supermarket in a needy neighborhood, if you would. But that's not the way people shop. And if you look at some of the experiments that are taking place, for example, in Detroit, where they've outfitted a bus, matter of fact, and that becomes a mobile food store where it goes to those neighborhoods, that's much smarter because a lot of these people don't have cars. You know, they're not going to go shopping, you know, for a week's worth of groceries. Typically, you know, they're living paycheck to paycheck, or if they're getting SNAP benefits or other kind of welfare benefits, a lot of the stores that serve them basically give them credit. They still have, you know, notebooks, and they'll put fill, you know, $20, and when I get my money, I'm going to go there and I'm going to pay them. So I think that, you know, this whole idea of building stores in these areas really doesn't understand how these people shop or how they live.
Okay, we will continue our conversation about the future of shopping, particularly grocery shopping, something most of us grew up one way with and are facing an entirely different way going forward with the opening of Amazon Go. That's a cashierless and cashless store that opened up in Seattle. You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. We're talking about the future of retail shopping and the consumer experience with the opening of Amazon Go in Seattle last week. It's the first cashless and cashierless store. It's a convenience store, but it was far from employee-less. There were plenty of people making the goods behind the scenes and also monitoring the situation out front. Still with us is CEO of Shoot Gerdeman. That's a retail design firm in Columbus, Brian Schaffley. By phone, grocery and retail industry analyst and founder of SupermarketGuru.com, Phil Lempert, and also retail columnist for Bloomberg, Sarah Halzack. 614-292-8513 is the number to call if you have a question or comment. You can also email us at allsides@wosu.org. Shoot Gerdeman has released a report on the future of retail and what that looks like. And some people are calling it a retail apocalypse. That's a negative take on all of this, Brian Schaffley.
Yeah, we're actually pushing back on that retail apocalypse. I mean, it's everything you read and hear in the news is all about, you know, store closings and you know, you walk through the mall and some of the familiar brands that you've seen are starting to disappear. And the reality is it's just an evolution. It's retail has always gone through these stages of evolution. When big box stores became prominent across the country, you know, local smaller stores started disappearing. And I think, as I mentioned before, it's survival of the fittest and you know, the new era of retail is all about consumer empowerment, customer empowerment, and people will shop the way they want to shop. And if retailers don't pay attention to the entire end-to-end experience of shopping, those retailers will go away.
Rob in Canton, you're on the air. Hi, Rob.
Hi.
Go ahead.
My question is, I'm a foodie, so I like to go and pick each individual tomato out mm-hmm. and artichokes, et cetera, et cetera. I don't want to eat an RFID chip. So who's going to be allowing me to have, you know, loose vegetables and things instead of prepackaged stuff that someone else has chosen? And if there aren't clerks to have the jobs, who's going to buy these refrigerators with scales in them, et cetera?
Phil Lempert?
Sure. Well, the good news is you're not going to eat an RFID chip. There is some technology, matter of fact, out there right now where they are experimenting with having sensors that are edible, but I don't think we're going to get that way. And I think that when we do have automatic replenishment on certain things, you're going to have more time, you know, to pick that tomato, to pick that avocado, and really get into it. I don't think that when we look at produce items, it is possible, and you know, Tesco's Fresh and Easy store proved this, that you have to, you know, shrink wrap every single product. That was the problem with Fresh and Easy in my mind. When you walked in, they had beautiful produce, and in fact, they were the only store ever to put an expiration date on every, you know, apple and every tomato and so on, but it was shrink wrapped in plastic, and that's not the way we want to shop. You know, I think that our best experiences have become our expectations, and a lot of that has been driven by great retailers, whether it's Eataly or other stores. So I think we're just going to get back into, you know, having more people have a great connection with food, and again, getting rid of, you know, some of those things that, you know, are unemotional cans and boxes and jars in the center of the store.
Rob, thanks a lot for that call. Did that help?
Yes, a little bit.
Okay. Are you worried, Rob?
Yes. I actually live in a food desert. I'm a high-income person that lives in a food desert for strange reasons. And I don't really want a totally automated store. I want to be able to, you know, pick up the apple. I want to interact with the butcher. I want to have that retail experience that I wouldn't get just by walking into a totally prepackaged algorithm store.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know, food is a very, very visceral subject to people worldwide.
Yeah.
Absolutely. And I think that to your point, we're going to be able to provide better experiences, you know, because of that. I don't think everything is going to be prepackaged, and I don't think everything is going to be unemotional at all.
Rob, thanks a lot for that call. You know, Sarah Halzack, a lot of people, I mean, I like grocery shopping. It's sort of, it started as a getaway when I had a young child. But it's turned into something that I do. I'm like Rob. I like to pick up every tomato. I like going to the farmer's market especially. What is your sense about that experience for people and if that might be taken away from us at some point?
Yeah, I think there are a lot of people out there who are just like you and who really do like that sensory experience and who like to leave their house to do their shopping. And
yeah,
that's why I think what Brian was saying earlier is absolutely true, that where retail is evolving is to a place where consumers have choice and where you really have good options for if you are more in a convenience and just knocking out an errand frame of mind, mm-hmm, or when you're in more of a frame of mind for an emotional experience. I think the retailers that thrive and survive are going to offer you options for both and are going to try to recognize through things like big data which kinds of purchases lend themselves to which thing. No one needs an experience when they're buying toilet paper, right? And this is sort of what Phil was getting at earlier about the what kinds of things will just be automatic replenishment purchases. You don't need an experience when you're buying toilet paper, but you do want an experience perhaps when you're trying to pick out a steak for your Valentine's Day dinner.
So, and Sarah, you're too young to remember the commercials where they squeeze the charm in that.
I do vaguely remember those, but I'll admit that's not a behavior I do in the store.
Right.
And
yeah,
you know the secret of squeezing the charm.
What?
Well, what Procter & Gamble did is that inner core used to be a very heavy cardboard, and what they did is they made that inner core thinner. So that's why you were squeezing the Charmin. It had nothing to do with the toilet paper itself. It was that inner core.
They're very smart, Benji.
Email from Chris. Are your panelists familiar with Sam's Club Scan and Go app? I love it. It allows you to scan and pay for your items, completely skipping the checkout. The person at the door does use a gun to pull up your receipt to give a quick eyeball to the items in your cart. That reminds me of what they do at Costco. Sarah Halzack?
Yeah, I I am familiar with that technology, and I think that exactly gets at sort of what we were talking about just a moment ago, mm-hmm. which is that there's no one solution that's going to be right for everybody and for every shopping format. For a format like Sam's, which is a huge, you know, square footage and where you do want to sort of wander around and pick up items and see what catches your eye, Scan & Go is a really good solution. It does allow you to skip the line, but also it doesn't require this, you know, crazy network of cameras and sensors that Amazon is relying on in Amazon Go. And so I think we will continue to see more innovation in that lane as well. It will just be about what is the right format and right fit for that specific retailer and the kind of merchandise that they sell.
Yeah, we're watching Kroger. They're testing a similar thing called Scan, Buy, and Go, which is similarly named, interestingly, in several hundred stores this year. I mean, Kroger is really upping their game in the technology department. They've experimented with changing shelf edge pricing.
What does that mean?
Well, it's like dynamic pricing. If you're overstocked in one item, you can lower the price. And if you're selling out of something, you can raise the price. I mean, these are all things that are very commonplace on the online world. You know, sort of supply and demand driven dynamic pricing. We're starting to see some of that happen in grocery stores.
Which brings up an interesting question that's been brought up before when it comes to online shopping. Is it, are we all getting charged the same amount of money? Or are some of us, luckier than others, depending? Phil Lempert, I mean, when it comes to food, that seems like questionable.
Well, it does, and to your point, no, we're not all getting charged the same thing online.
Mm-hmm. Right.
There's no question about that. But keep in mind, one of the differences is food does have a very low margin, especially, you know, a lot of perishable foods. The produce department has an enormous waste problem. So if, in fact, we can have dynamic pricing in produce, in some of these goods that as they move closer to their expiration date, the price comes down in order to avoid waste, I think that's a good thing. I don't think we're there yet by any stretch of the imagination, but I do think we are seeing retailers experiment with this.
Mm-hmm. Is there an ethical piece to all of this as far as what the stores that provide our food should be doing, could be doing? We had Rob call from Canton, who's worried about people who, debate. You can, we can debate, but we all can agree we know what we're talking about when we say food deserts. There's not enough places to shop. Is there an ethical piece to this that's we should have expectations for when it comes to our grocery stores? Sarah Halsack?
So I think this is a really interesting thing for companies to ponder, especially right now, because we are seeing that millennials are definitely thinking about whether the places they shop are good corporate citizens and whether they feel comfortable with their social responsibility elements, and that is weighing on their purchasing. So besides the fact that perhaps, if you're a senior executive, you just want to feel good when you go to sleep at night about the ethical decisions you're making as a business person, I think there is also a financial case to be really thinking about the ethics of your model and, how you're serving your customer, and because that can create just sort of a general halo that makes people want to shop with you more. And so I do think that food retailers are very smart to think about all manner of ethical issues, not just poverty and food deserts, but sustainability, cruelty to animals, all those kinds of things, those are increasingly shaping shoppers' decisions.
Yeah, Phil.
And also,
yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, just to build on what Sarah just said, also nutrition. Keep in mind that one of the huge problems that we have facing us is obesity. It's high blood pressure. It's heart disease. It's all those things. So I would love to see more retailers really take a stand. I mean, we have it in the Midwest with Hy-Vee that has a registered dietitian in every store, at least one. We have it on the East Coast with ShopRite supermarkets, same thing. I mean, they're curating goods to
make that experience better. They're upping the game when it comes to their store brands. Aldi has just released a whole new line of vegan foods. Aldi also came across with their private label and said they're not going to use certain ingredients.
Right.
So I really hope that these retailers are really going to focus on nutrition as well as all the things that Sarah just said.
Phil Lempert, thanks for joining us today. I appreciate your time again.
My pleasure.
Phil Lempert, grocery and retail industry analyst and founder of SupermarketGuru.com. Also, Brian Schaffley, he is CEO of Shute Gerdeman, which is a retail design firm in Columbus. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
And Sarah Halzack is a retail columnist for Bloomberg. Sarah, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you.
Thanks to everybody else for your emails, for your calls, and thanks especially for listening. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.